The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to The Christian Outlook, the weekly radio program that sorts through the issues in our fast-changing world in a way that honors your Christian faith. Sponsored by the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy, I'm Georgine Rice. This week, the Biden administration pushes two radical pieces of legislation that would fundamentally alter our democracy.
They are bills that would fundamentally transform how elections are conducted in our country.
We'll get analysis from Albert Mohler.
The very intention of this legislation is to make the federal government largely in charge of elections.
The Supreme Court hears the challenge to the Biden administration's vaccine mandate.
This is the most lawless administration that I've ever seen.
The key question, does any president have the power, the constitutional authority, to unilaterally force the population to take a vaccine?
Why is this not something that individual business owners should be dealing with?
We've got all this and more. I'm Georgine Rice, your host. It's great to be with you. I'm coming to you from Portland and my home station of KPDQ. You can hear my own program live each weekday afternoon on 93.9 FM here in Portland and online via our website at kpdq.com and also through the TuneIn radio app. Thanks for joining us. We'll begin in Washington, D.C. with a look at a couple of pieces of legislation that deserve our attention. I'm talking about the Freedom to Vote Act and the John R. Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. While the bill's title sounds benign, titles can be misleading. To learn more about what's really behind them, we'll first turn to Zach Smith of the Heritage Foundation. He joined me on my program here in Portland. Is free and fair elections, is that the centerpiece of what the president is championing? And we can look at the specific legislation. But generally speaking, what is the goal here for the administration and his allies?
Well, unfortunately, it doesn't appear to be safeguarding our election process here in the United States. Really, these bills, these so-called election integrity bills, are being pushed for partisan political advantage. And we have to look at this, like you mentioned, Georgine, through the larger debate about the filibuster, whether the filibuster should be altered or abolished, because if the filibuster, which currently requires two-thirds of senators to agree to end debate on the issue, if that is abolished, then the Democratic majority in the Senate could simply push through many different aspects of their radical policy agenda. And so, unfortunately, I think these election reform bills are being proposed and pushed as a potential wedge issues, trying to put pressure on Democratic senators like Joe Manchin, like Kyrsten Sinema, who have opposed filibuster reform, trying to put pressure on them to come on board and abolish the filibuster so the Democratic Party can get their wish list through the Senate.
Well, as I mentioned, the president delivered a speech about voting rights in Georgia. It's an historically Republican state that narrowly won in 2020. He said there's an urgent need to pass legislation to protect the constitutional right to vote and the integrity of our elections. Explain what the president is proposing in these two pieces of legislation that we're talking about, the Freedom to Vote Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act.
Well, I don't disagree with Joe Biden that legislation needs to be passed to protect the integrity of our electoral system. I disagree with him about the specific policies that are being proposed and what body should pass those policies. The president, Kamala Harris, Vice President Kamala Harris, they're pushing for federal legislation to be passed through Congress, whereas common sense election integrity measures should be passed in state legislatures around the country. And we at Heritage have been working to help states get those measures passed. But essentially, the bills that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are pushing, the Freedom to Vote Act, the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, those are pieces of federal legislation that would radically alter how elections are conducted in our country, or transfer power away from state and local governments, transfer that power to the federal government, in many instances, transferring that power to unelected bureaucrats in the Department of Justice's Civil Rights Division, which is historically been very left-leaning, very hostile to common sense voter integrity measures. But not only would these two pieces of legislation prohibit states from enacting certain common sense election integrity measures like requiring voter ID, they would also affirmatively require states to implement policies and procedures that would inherently make elections less secure. They would prohibit states from taking certain actions to maintain the integrity of their voter rolls. They would require states to automatically register voters. They would take away the ability of state legislatures to redistrict congressional districts within their state. And there's a whole host of very bad policy proposals in these bills. But the bottom line is, these are very bad bills, very dangerous bills. These are bills that would fundamentally transfer power away from states to Washington, D.C., and they are bills that would fundamentally transform how elections are conducted in our country.
Now, why are Senator Sinema and Manchin, why are they resistant? Why they support the two bills, but I, my understanding is the rule change to pass them is what they object to?
Yes, they do object to the abolishing the filibuster. You know, and I think if you listen to what Joe Manchin has said in the past, he's made the very common sense point that you and I were just talking about, that if today's Democratic majority abolishes the filibuster, when the Democrats are in the minority in the Senate in the future, then they will no longer have the ability to filibuster legislation that they disagree with. And so for now, it appears that Joe Manchin, Kyrsten Sinema are the only cooler heads prevailing among the Democratic senators in the Senate. But I think this renewed focus on these so-called election integrity bills are really designed to try to put as much pressure as possible on Manchin and Sinema to support abolishing the filibuster, which I'm hopeful they will hold the line, stick to their convictions, and not vote to change that time-honored Senate tradition.
Where do Republicans stand, not just on the filibuster, but on voting rights legislation?
Well, look, I think most Republicans, and this should really be a non-controversial position, take the view that voting should be easy. It should be easy to vote and hard to cheat. And requiring things like a photo ID is not placing an onerous burden on voters, especially if states make IDs freely available if someone can't otherwise afford one, which they should do. And if you look at the polling on this issue, many Americans, the vast majority of Americans, agree that requiring photo ID, encouraging people to vote in person at polling stations, those types of common sense measures are good and appropriate, and at the end of the day, help us have more confidence in the outcomes of our elections.
Confidence in our elections will not be the fruit of these two legislative proposals should they become the law of the land. But the president has taken this case on the road in what looks like a sort of Hail Mary pass or desperate move. Albert Mohler explains from his Briefing podcast.
Speaking in Atlanta, a highly partisan president of the United States said this, quote, "As an institutionalist, I believe that the threat to our democracy is so grave that we must find a way to pass these voting rights bills." The president continued, quote, "Let the majority prevail, and if that bare minimum is blocked, we have no option but to change the Senate rules, including getting rid of the filibuster for this," end quote. Heightening the situation dramatically, the president also said, quote, "I ask every elected official in America, do you want to be on the side of Dr. King," meaning Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., whose church, Ebenezer Baptist Church, was in the background here, "or George Wallace?" Again, he said, "Do you want to be on the side of Dr. King or George Wallace?" Speaking of the very controversial former governor of Alabama, well known for his historic support of segregation. He changed his mind, but we get the point of what the president is saying here. But in worldview perspective, one of the things we need to note is that if a politician, if a government leader is going to use this kind of language, two things pertain. Number one, you better not use it very often. And secondly, it better fit the historical context. And in the second case, it certainly fails here. The president of the United States is pushing highly partisan legislation, and he is doing so claiming nothing less than a moral mandate because democracy itself, he says, is at risk. The political stakes for the president are very high. The president has announced that he must have this legislation passed. Of course, he said that about the Build Back Better bill that also didn't pass in recent days. And that was taking place even as he's the president and there is a Democratic majority in both houses of Congress. He still didn't get it through. And the problem there was not Republican opposition. The problem there, as in this case, is that the president can't deliver all the votes from the senators of his own party. But as I said, there are some other very big issues here. One just comes down to the question of what kind of voting rights, what kind of voting pattern, what kind of voting policies, laws, structures should be in place. At this point, it's very important to recognize that the United States Constitution leaves the basic organizing of almost all elections, including elections to national office, to the states. That's a part of our system of federalism. Federalism, you may remember, is a system of sharing power and authority between the states and the federal government. And it's analogous to the separation of powers. The same logic. You do not want too much concentration of power. You don't want the states acting individually in such a way that there is no union, but you do not want the federal government trampling upon the rightful constitutional authority and powers of the state. The Republicans are crying foul when it comes to these two bills, especially to the second one, because the very intention of this legislation is to make the federal government largely in charge of elections. And that's not just a new political development. That would be a repudiation of our constitutional system and order. It's also really important we recognize that the vote, the right of citizens to vote, is a huge issue within the United States. And it has itself been a controversial issue. And you look through the history of the United States and you come to understand, even you could put into a larger context, the history of Western civilization or the English-speaking peoples on both sides of the Atlantic. The bottom line is that there has been a progressive, and I mean that in the historical sense, there has been a progress of expanding the right to vote to all citizens. And by the time you reach 1965, the United States Congress had to take action in order to make clear that the United States Constitution granted to all citizens the right to vote, regardless of color of skin. And that comes down to something that was the responsibility of the United States Congress. And just looking at the math, the Voting Rights Act of 1965 passed in the Senate by a vote of 77-19. That's overwhelming. The reauthorization of that same bill that took place in 1980 passed in the Senate 85-8. Again, a very strong statement, a very clear bipartisan statement. But now you have two bills that are being brought forward by President Biden and by the Democratic leadership in the Senate. And the big problem is neither the majority leader nor the president can come up with 50 votes, much less the 60 votes necessary. The progressivist wing of American politics is extremely frustrated with the very existence of the United States Senate, and they see the sands running through the hourglass. They see the time running out because they fully expect to lose the Democratic majority in the United States House as a consequence of the midterm elections to be held later this year.
Coming up, vaccine mandates before the Supreme Court.
This is the most lawless administration that I've ever seen with regards to overriding or trying to override the constitutional and statutory rights of its citizens.
The Christian Outlook returns in a moment.
The Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy believes in the calling to politics and public service. As one of the few programs of its kind based at a leading Christian university, we prepare students for exciting careers in this vital arena through a curriculum that combines rigorous study of America's founding principles with the latest tools of policy analysis. The application period for fall 2022 classes has begun, so find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Georgine Rice. On January 7th, the Supreme Court heard arguments on two sets of challenges to the vaccine mandates coming from the Biden administration. In November of last year, the administration announced that they'd use OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, to force private employers to vaccinate their employees. Well, the move is now impacting workers and their families all across the nation. Don Crow turned to Matt Staver of Liberty Council from WAVA in the nation's capital.
Can you tell us further about Friday's proceedings on this very important matter? How did it go?
Well, I think as it relates to the OSHA mandate, I think there is going to be a majority of justices that will block it. As it relates, and that's on the employers of 100 or more employees. As it relates to the Medicaid, Medicare mandate for health care workers and facilities, I'm not quite sure which the direction the Supreme Court will go, but I'm concerned that it might not be blocked, but we'll see. But at the end of the day, I'm also concerned about the lack of information and the misstatements that were made by some of these justices. You know, you expect justices to ask questions and you expect them to even take positions and argue for or against a particular situation to see where the counsel will ultimately go based upon what's in the record, based upon the legal arguments and the evidence that's actually in the record. But what we found is that certain statements were made, particularly, for example, by Justice Sotomayor, that even some of the newspapers have come out and given four Pinocchios to, and PolitiFact has come out and made a statement saying that what she said was wrong. And even the director of the CDC came out and said that that was wrong. She mentioned that there's 100,000 children that are in serious situation. And yet the CDC says, no, it's more like about 3,500 children. But of those children, about 40% of those are not in the hospital because of COVID. They're in there with COVID. They got admitted for some other reason, but after they got admitted, they were tested positive for COVID. So the reason for being there and their treatment is not because of COVID. It was for some other reason. So that number is even much, much less. And yet Justice Sotomayor used the figure of 100,000 children. So some of those statements are very concerning because you don't expect justices to be that far off base with regards to the actual facts that they're supposed to be taking into consideration on a case before them.
And is this not something that millions of Americans have been concerned about from day one, that we get inconsistent reports of numbers of hospitalizations and numbers of deaths to COVID, and yet so often those figures don't stand up to accurate analysis and have not for the last couple of years?
No, that's right. In fact, you know, take, for example, theirs, the vaccine reporting system, and it indicates about, you know, then over a million people that have had adverse reactions, and it comes up with different reports every week in terms of those numbers climbing. But a report just came out, a study just came out from some professors at Columbia University, and those professors said that actually the number of deaths from COVID shots are around 400,000, or about 20 times more than what VAERS is reporting. So that makes a big serious issue here with some of the reporting data. You know, we really need to have accurate reporting data, and the justices or anyone else need to avoid this hyperbole in terms of the use of the numbers. Justice Breyer also engaged in some of that hyperbole that wasn't quite accurate. And then there was also a tremendous lack of information with regards to the workplace. One of the justices said that during COVID, virtually every employer was shut down and very, very few were open. Well, they should know better than that, because that data and those information were in front of the court multiple times in the church litigation cases. In fact, the court actually repeatedly mentioned all the different categories of businesses that were allowed to operate. Large segments of our society were allowed to operate, while churches, for example, were under severe restrictions. So they know that from the church litigation that we just went through, but yet they made statements as though some of those are completely unaware of what actually is happening in the workplace.
You also noted in the report that we got on your website, as a matter of fact, check it out, folks, at libertycouncil.com. Currently, the mandate is blocked in half the country's states amid ongoing litigation. However, this week, the Biden administration will ask the high court to overrule lower courts that halted the policy in those 25 states. So the Biden administration's not taking this sitting down, so to speak. They're pushing back at the state level. Can you tell us more?
Yeah, they are pushing back at the state level. First of all, they lifted and they want to impose them. Secondly, they're actually imposing in some of those places where the mandate hasn't been imposed, they're imposing the deadline to begin. so that the mandate actually starts to go into effect. And then from there, you have masking, testing, and then eventually, as we move into February, you've got the first and then later on the second shot that you have to get. And then you have the big penalties that come if you're in non-compliant status. So, in fact, even after some of these courts issued injunctions, Joe Biden actually said to these employers to just go ahead and impose the mandate anyway and essentially ignore what the courts were doing. This is the most lawless administration that I've ever seen with regards to overriding or trying to override the constitutional and statutory rights of its citizens. And we see this, for example, in the military. We have a major case against all the different branches of the military under the Department of Defense. And last Friday, they were ordered to begin the first of their every two-week reports, and it showed over 21,000 religious exemption requests were provided by these different men and women in the military, and none were granted. And that's what we predicted was going to happen. That's actually what is happening. And yet these are men and women in the military that spend their lives and give their lives defending their Constitution, and yet they're being denied the very constitutional freedoms that they defend.
In his discussion with Charmaine Yost of the Heritage Foundation, Kevin McCullough gets right to the heart of the matter. Does the president have that much power? From AM 570, The Mission in New York City.
I was pleased with the kind of matter-of-fact way Justice Thomas and Justice Alito kind of just asked some point blank questions to the counsel. And it seems to me that I don't know where Chief Justice Roberts is going to be. He seemed to ask a lot of process questions about how the executive order, you know, kind of comes into effect and what OSHA can do and so forth, which I think is all going to be looked at. But I think at the end of the day, This is really a fundamental issue. Can a president, without consulting the legislature, force citizens to take a form of medicine unilaterally? And when we've had immunization policy and other things in the past, I don't believe it's come from the executive branch. I think that there's always been, on some level, you know, legislative buy-in, which then by decree says that the people are involved in the process. I'm hoping that they find that distinction. We'll have to wait and see, though.
Well, and I think that's a really good point. And one of the justices that I heard, and we'll have to go back and see when we get the transcripts as to exactly what the back and forth was on it, got to that point exactly of saying, you know, why is this not something that Congress, that individual business owners should be dealing with and making their own decisions? And I think that's that really is the is the point. But, you know, just to drive this home, though, Kevin, is, you know, given the fact that this is such an unprecedented situation, you know, this question of misinformation and misunderstanding of the bare bones reality of what we're facing really is troubling to me, because there's been so much thrown out there about, oh, this is misinformation, this is disinformation.
Right.
Coming up, responding to the Great Resignation.
A lot of folks are going to find themselves facing unemployment, even worse jobs. So there's going to be a great reckoning, I think, that's going to come ultimately on the heels of this.
When the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. I'm Georgine Rice. The Great Resignation. Some people have referred to it as the big quit, but those labels refer to record numbers of workers quitting their jobs. Others who were laid off early in the pandemic are saying essentially no thank you to job openings and opportunities to get back to work. Well, the veteran author Stephen Mansfield recently wrote about that phenomenon. Here's John Hall and Kathy Emmons on Word FM in Pittsburgh.
You talked at length about the Great Resignation. And, you know, this is a phenomenon, I think, that's a direct result of the pandemic and COVID, where people have, you know, spent time at home. And while they were at home, they were like, you know what, I think I can do better. When we go back, I'm going to shed myself of my old career and hit the reset button and start fresh.
You know, that's very true. Maybe the best way for me to express this is to say that I once had a near-death experience. And when I emerged from that, I said, you know what? There's some stuff I'm not putting up with. There's some things I'm going to try to make better in my life. And I just, there's no need, given that life is short, to tolerate, you know, a whole lot of mess in my life. This is what people have done as they've emerged from the pandemic. They were sitting at home, they were facing death, they were contemplating their life. And when they emerged, to the extent that we have thus far, they said, you know what? I don't need to put up with bad bosses. I don't need to put up with low pay. Life's too short. I'm either going to strike out on my own and start my own venture, or I'm going to look for better work.
So people essentially are reinventing themselves, right? They're, like I said, hitting the reset button. That takes a measure of thoughtfulness and especially courage to think, whatever age I am, I'm going to, you know, be something new.
Well, it does. And this is largely driven by the young, I need to say. Older folks like you and me, John, you know, we probably like to stay put, yeah, have the benefits and enjoy our work. But the millennials grew up in a world of choice. You know the stats as well as I do. What, 80 different kinds of mustard, you know, all sorts of options, an app for everything. And so they're driving this. They have said, look, life's too short. I'm not going to put up with this. I don't need to be in a bad situation, in a toxic work environment. And so they're striking out. The other good part of this is that's a very entrepreneurial generation. You know, they like those. They're the ones who fuel those TV shows about, you know, toxic bosses and about, you know, work and entrepreneurship and what have you. So they're driving this for the most part. It's an exciting time. But you may know that I've also said publicly, I think we're also going to have another movement, which is the Great Reckoning. And that is, I'm all for the idealism. Hey, let's go start our own business. Hey, let's go switch to find something better. But the fact is, reality is going to smack some folks in the face. Some will land in better jobs. Some will have successful entrepreneurial vision, ventures. But a lot of folks are going to find themselves facing unemployment, even worse jobs. So there's going to be a great reckoning, I think, that's going to come ultimately on the heels of this.
Yeah, I think you're right. And just knowing what it's like to be in a workplace for any extended length of time, one of the things that we have to come to grips with is the fact that a lot of the things that we don't want to do, we still should do. Right. They're things that our employers requiring of us, or things that our coworkers are requiring of us. And it's something that we're not really comfortable with, or not comfortable, but it's just it's some kind of structure that we don't necessarily want. But that doesn't make it bad. You know, submitting to that has certainly been in my history a path for growth. It's just a path of like becoming more humble, becoming more open to what other people around me have to say, and, you know, going forward in that way. So just the whole idea of, well, I don't like this and I don't need to put up with this, that's only going to last you so far.
And that's absolutely true. And even that is somewhat of a generational thing. I talk to my kids when they tell me, Dad, you can't believe how the boss is. Dad, you can't believe what they're requiring of me at work. You know, my thinking is this is something to grow through, something to improve through, something that's going to make you stronger. They see hardship as something to avoid, something to that means, hey, it's time to make a change. So this is part of the issue. And I warned them, you know, you can make a change, and some change is good. And sometimes bad work environments can drive you on to greater things. At the same time, don't be someone who's just perpetually dissatisfied. We have initials we use in our home, PDS, perpetual dissatisfaction syndrome. Mm-hmm. I think if the millennials could learn a little bit from the greatest generation that went through the Great Depression, hey, hang in, hang on to your job, endure hardship, see even a toxic boss as a chance to grow, and don't assume that there's automatically greater riches just around the corner. You know, right, there's something to be said for the discipline that makes you better.
Exactly. But, you know, at the same time, too, and I appreciate this, that it, like I talked about earlier, it takes a measure of courage, like you, with your near-death experience. And you got to admire people who do that, who do reinvent themselves, who do have that measure of courage, who do see something in themselves, and they think, man, I'm going to go for this. And, you know, that's, I think, probably fueling all those months of sitting at home and making the Great Resignation happen.
Coming up, a conversation on religious liberty.
In the Muslim world, they actually respect a person of faith and person that stands on principle, because then they understand who they're sitting across the table from.
When the Christian Outlook returns in a moment, stay with us. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Georgine Rice.
As we track with the issue of religious liberty, both here at home and across the world, it's very clear that there are some disturbing trends. One point worth noting, if the United States doesn't lead on this issue, there's really no other nation to take up the mantle on behalf of believers. The trend we're seeing from the Biden administration, well, they are concerning. Don Crow turned to Hedia Miramati, who wrote about it in a recent piece in the Christian Post. Hedia is a convert from Islam, a Muslim background believer, and a bold voice on behalf of our first freedom. From Don's program on WAVA.
I would like you to elaborate on the fact that the tide has risen against Christians. So let's start there, because that's where you start with your column.
So in Nigeria, Tony Perkins, actually, who happens to be a religious freedom commissioner and also runs a family research council, says that he estimates 8,000 Christians were murdered in cold blood between January and September of this year alone in Nigeria. It's referred to as one of the killing fields of defenseless Christians. And it's just an absolute tragedy that at this point, what's happening across the country in this almost to the levels of a genocide, and Blinken actually removes them as a country of particular concern from the Religious Freedom Report.
I do understand that the secretary, as you put it, reprimanded Nigeria for its lack of free press and dismal human rights record. But he undid whatever little impact that may have had. I would say he undid that by his act of removing Nigeria as a country of particular concern.
Right. And this is actually, and the reason the CPC, as we refer to it, designation is important is because it gives Congress a pathway to impose economic sanctions. And by lifting it, it basically removes that power from Congress to do that. And another example I gave in the article is the aggression of Turkey and Azerbaijan against Armenia, where in the 100-year anniversary of the genocide, even though President Biden is the first president to acknowledge the genocide, which is very important, Blinken then turns around and gives millions of dollars in new aid to Azerbaijan without the required guarantee that they would not militarily attack Armenia. And as a consequence, the Azeri president sends troops and invades Armenia proper, using it as basically a signal that his efforts would not be stopped.
You also note more than 340 million Christians are dealing with persecution on a daily, on a regular basis. Take us into some of the other areas, Middle East, Africa, Asia, very high levels of persecution, as you point out. What more can you tell us specifically about some of these other countries?
So interestingly, that unfortunately, that statistic is now at 400 million Christians live in lands of persecution. So of the countries, that means literally one out of every eight Christians faces severe consequences just based on their faith, which is really quite astonishing. And tragic, to tell you the truth. And unfortunately, a lot of them are in Muslim countries. So it is throughout the Middle East and Africa and Asia. And of course, some of these countries have been designated by the U.S. government in the Religious Freedom Report, such as China, Iran, Pakistan, Russia, Saudi Arabia, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, India, which was actually not listed, has been one of the most violent years for the Christian minority since independence in 1947, where attacks against Christians rose nearly 75%. So, I mean, if you ask me what I think is, it's kind of a combination of looking at the United States and our weakened stance and look at the assassination and the massacre of Christians in Afghanistan now that we've withdrawn, is that the world sees the United States as weaker and not willing to stand up and defend the values that it cherishes and that it represents our democracy and American exceptionalism, quite frankly. And as a consequence, these other nations, and especially the radical Islamic ones, use it as a license to be aggressive against their internal populations that they don't appreciate or want, and also against their neighbors, as in the case of Turkey and Azerbaijan. So when they don't think the U.S. will do something, then it's time for them to do things that are more bold than they would otherwise do.
Now, you touched on,
unfortunate.
It is indeed. You touched on this point a little a moment ago, but I wanted to have you expand a little bit. You said that, early in March of this past year, you opined that the plight of Christians worldwide would get worse under this current administration. Sadly, it has. But then you said it's just not the outcome. It's not just the outcome of partisan politics, but represents a principle with far-reaching consequences. And you talked about that briefly as to this administration and how it views human rights versus religious freedom contra that of Trump's administration. Take us back there and flesh that out a bit more.
Sure. So this is the policy that this administration is following, and which they've vocalized publicly, is an interdependence of human rights. And religious freedom is just one of the many democratic rights that it'll balance with competing interests, whether those competing interests are human rights issues, and oftentimes this administration in particular brings up LGBTQ rights, similar to what Obama's administration did, and focusing on, economic, national security, whatever it may be. But the difference with the previous administration is that it was a hierarchy of rights, meaning religious freedom was the first right, as it is in our Constitution, from which all the other rights would flow. And you can appreciate how important that stance is and how much more other countries respect that stance. Because people think, and Secretary Pompeo was widely criticized for referring to himself when he was in Egypt at his first presentation there, saying, "Hi, my name is Secretary Mike Pompeo, and I'm an evangelical Christian." But what people don't realize is in the Muslim world, they actually respect a person of faith and person that stands on principle, because then they understand who they're sitting across the table from. For the majority of mainstream Muslims, yes, they just want basic things out of life. They want not only freedom to practice their religion, but they want safety, security, the well-being of their children. They want economic prosperity. And so you're right. They don't want anyone slaughtered, not themselves or their neighbors. And oftentimes, and this is something I used to talk about quite often when I was a Muslim, because I was part of a sect that was persecuted, was that the extremists are slaughtering the Muslims first. So in their local countries, they are slaughtering the moderate Muslims so that they could establish dominance even before they move on, oftentimes, to Christian or non-Muslim communities.
Coming up,
God chooses his choicest saints to suffer.
The Christian Outlook returns in a moment.
Wise men said, just walk this way.
The Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy believes in the calling to politics and public service. As one of the few programs of its kind based at a leading Christian university, we prepare students for exciting careers in this vital arena through a curriculum that combines rigorous study of America's founding principles with the latest tools of policy analysis. The application period for fall 2022 classes has begun, so find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Georgine Rice. In our last segment, we got a rare look into the suffering of our fellow believers around the world. But I am well aware these past 2 years have been marked by a multitude of tests and trials for many of us, including, but certainly not limited to, the pandemic. Here's Bob Burney, my colleague on The Word, WRFD, in Columbus.
God chooses his choicest saints to suffer. When someone faces a tragedy in their family, physically, emotionally, financially, our typical human response is, why is God mad at me? Why is God doing this? And of course, the classic, why would a loving God cause, or why would a loving God allow? That is our human response. But there is nothing biblical about that. If you look at the Bible and you think suffering, you do a quick word association. All right, I'm going to give you two words and you tell me what they are. Bible, suffering. Most people will immediately say Job. Of course, the entire book is about one man suffering. And yet, I think the most important take home from that whole thing with Job is that Job was a righteous man. In fact, he was the most righteous man on planet Earth. And it was God who initiated the test. Yeah, but Satan did all. Yeah, Satan did all that, but it was initiated by God. It was God who said, hey, have you considered my servant Job? It was God who said to Satan, hey, check out my servant Job. Look how he's serving me. And Satan said, well, yeah, the only reason he's serving you is because you're so good to him. Look what he's got. Look at that incredible family, those wonderful kids. Look at all the herds and the pasture and the big house. You have blessed him. You've given him so much. You take all that away from him and he will curse you. God says, go for it. Job was tested not because he was disobedient, not because he was being punished, but because God knew that Job would trust him. Did Job struggle? Oh, yeah, he struggled. But through it all, he trusted God.
Thank you for joining us for The Christian Outlook. Remember to subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Google Play, and never miss these and other great conversations. Thanks for joining us today. Our program has been brought to you in part through our partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. For executive producer Russell Shubin and producers Charlie Richards, David Pouchon, Mike Cook, Alex Perez, and James Blend, I'm Georgine Rice. Join us again next time for The Christian Outlook. But it flew away from her reach, so she ran away in her sleep.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.